Today and for the next four Mondays on the Radio Cafe, we present Thinking Like a Watershed, a series of panel discussions that focus on responses to the water crisis in the West. Each of these panels is intended to provide various cultural perspectives concerning global warming and climate change. They are produced and moderated by oral historian and author Jack Loeffler. The first one that we're about to hear was recorded in February of this year at the Chemo Theater in Albuquerque. It features William Dubuis, author of A Great Aridness, Patty Limerick, author of The Legacy of Conquest, and John Nichols, author of The Milagro Beanfield War. And now, Jack Loeffler.
Watershed is an amazing entity. Geographically, it's an area that is contained within sloping hillsides, mountainsides that drain to a central main stem. It could be very small. It can be an arroyo, can be a watershed. In our case, it's the Rio Grande, the headwaters of which are up in the San Juan Mountains, up in Colorado, and flow into what is now the Rio Grande, which used to go east, I'm told, by Paul Bauer, who is a fantastic hydrologist down in Socorro, but somehow got rearranged and now goes all the way down, or should go all the way down, to the Gulf of Mexico. Now, in some strange way, over the last who knows how many hundred years, we have somehow neglected to really see ourselves as part of habitat. And we have forgotten that we are but a single animal species within all of the habitats, and we're just about everywhere right now. We inhabit watersheds like mad. We're a keystone species. But we don't act like we should in a lot of ways. And so that's what these panels are about. We're looking at watersheds as a metaphor, thinking like a watershed as a metaphor for understanding that you have to see a whole array of factors all at the same time and in motion, because it's always changing. And if we can keep that in our minds as we go through this evening, we'll be in really good shape. We're really trying to understand how we can rearrange our cultural attitudes to include homeland and put it at the head of the table and serve it instead of constantly extracting. We are so fortunate to have an incredible array of fellow panelists this evening. I'm just knocked out by our great good fortune. And I'm not going to list everybody's array of deeds and accomplishments because they speak for themselves. But I would like to ask you to join me in welcoming our three panelists, Patty Limerick, John Nichols, and William Dubuis. We're lucky. We're really lucky. Each one of our panelists will make a brief presentation. Without further ado, I would like to ask our good pal, John Nichols, to begin. Thanks, John.
I have many thoughts about the issues we're discussing tonight, and I'm sure that you all have many thoughts about them also. My love of nature was nurtured in me from childhood by a family of naturalists. My politics were fired in the anti-Vietnam movement of the mid-1960s. When I re-educated myself completely about American history, civil rights, and environmental destruction. And I quickly became hyperbolically hysterical about where I felt things were headed. 46 years ago, when I was 28 and living in New York City, I scribbled this futuristic spasm into my diary. I had terrible dreams of doom, but not of 1984 nor of on the beach, rather just of mess. corruption, decay, pollution, apathy, things falling apart, general breakdown, the end of resources, total befouling of the environment, starvation, and the cruelest of all anarchies, the display at last of the core of men's soul, avalanches of bricks like avalanches of melting snow, the air that suffocated people like an atmosphere of chocolate pudding, and a populace armed with outdated gas masks that no longer worked, and every stall broken down elevator in every urban skyscraper was filled with putrid corpses. We were destroying the world in order to save it. In my journal of that year, I also screamed, "Nothing we see in nature is ours. I think so many friends who don't care about a beetle or a plant, would there ever be anything in them that would make them want to save the land?" Swishpan, 28 years. And here's what I said in a short talk given at West Jackson's Prairie Festival in Salina, Kansas, on May 25th, 1996. I was now 56 years old. Quote, "All of us agree the planet is in trouble and we need radical solutions to problems of overpopulation, chemical agriculture, and social decay. Yet whether we're biologists, novelists, or social critic, I think we regularly fail to address the problem of revolution that will be required to bring about the sustainable and egalitarian world that we desire. Therefore, I wish more of us in our work would address in general philosophical terms the overall nature of capitalism, its effect on the planet, and the need to get rid of it. Clearly, in a world of finite resources, an economic system based on planned obsolescence and conspicuous consumption is a formula for planetary suicide. Capitalism is based on a philosophy of terminal growth. Drone, drone. The profit motive promotes class warfare and relegates three-fourths of humanity to humiliating living conditions while it destroys the land, air, water, and species that sustain us. To the extent that we choose to work within or consider ourselves bound by the rules of the system, our efforts will be doomed to failure and will eventually succumb to the juggernaut of capital development. Don't take my word for it, however." Like, let's listen to the country singer Merle Haggard, who once said famously, "Are we all just like a snowball that's headed downhill for hell?" Or let's listen to my fellow panelist, Jack Loeffler, who writes, quote, "It is obvious that we as a species are fructifying out of control and that unless we lessen our numbers, we'll crash, perhaps to follow the dodo into oblivion. To fail to heed this realization is not only irrational, it's tragic. To think that a species blessed with our level of capacity for consciousness continues to dance blithely ever closer to the edge of the abyss, driven by an array of archaic tenets spiced with obsolete paradigms, is absurd. Yet such seems the case." Jesus. Or let's listen to these cheerful words penned most recently by another of our panelists, Bill DeBuis. Quote, "Growth must be limited. The train must be stopped. But who is willing to stand on the tracks and flag it down? The economy of the region is predicated on continuous growth. Conversion to a new paradigm will require revolutionary economic change. In all likelihood, such change won't come until the train runs out of track. However, no one has suggested that the train of growth must one day be stopped or even slowed. Without a societal commitment to live within the limits of finite resources in an environment where climate speaks last and loudest, the ultimate train wreck, the final reckoning with aridity, becomes a certainty. This pattern of behavior may be quintessentially human. If one were to write a survey of all the instances in the history of civilization when societies accepted difficult medicine in order to spare their descendants worse pain in the future, it'd make a very short book." Myself, personally, I enjoy listening most to Patty Limerick, who is much less hysterical than us guys, and she promotes serious, common sense solutions to our dilemmas derived from the lessons that she has learned from studying history. For example, Patty once made a case for re-examining the Spanish explorer Juan Bautista de Anza by explaining the lessons that Anza's life had taught her. I quote, "If you are persuaded that killing is necessary, then kill without regret." When, in 1779, Anza traveled into what is now the state of Colorado, his mission was to invade Comanche territory to strike a military blow that would demoralize the Comanches and eliminate Cuerno Verde, the chief who had led his people on many raids into Spanish territory and killed many Spaniards and Pueblo Indians. In the battle at Greenhorn Mountain, Anza and his men killed Cuerno Verde, as well as his eldest son, the heir to his command, his four leading captains, and his shaman, along with 10 more warriors. One Spanish soldier was lightly wounded. While Anza is very appropriately known as a maker of peace, it is also true that he was an effective and spirited maker of war. Continuing in the vein of morally unsettling historical lessons, lesson 6 about Anza seems to be this: don't kill people if you don't have to, but if you are convinced that you have to, then kill them wholeheartedly.
Lordy.
I, for one, at age 73 now, am eager to take that advice from Patty Limerick via Juan Bautista de Anza in my forthcoming battles to confront, without regret, the CEOs of corporate America who are so willy-nilly destroying the Southwest and, coincidentally, all the rest of the planet surrounding us. And if I need to kill them, I plan to do so wholeheartedly. So I welcome you to this evening's entertainment.
Beautiful, John. Wow. Well, there's an act to follow.
Jesus.
So I'm going to ask Brother DeBuies to follow. Bill DeBuies.
It's just not fair, Jack.
I know.
Well, I'm not going to promise any mayhem. I'll just do my usual gloom and doom for you, but prefacing it with something joyful, and that is that if you like to watch lands and waters change, if you like to watch how societies react to stress, congratulations, you've been born to the best period of modern human history you could possibly want to enjoy. So here we go, and I'm going to show, because John thinks I'm a chicken to use images like this, and he's completely right. So I'm going to hide a bit behind images, but here's the current news. You've been reading about California, and this is the U.S. drought map for just, 2 weeks ago. And you can see some pretty big problems. This is extraordinary drought in this area. What do they call it? Exceptional drought. And this is merely extreme drought. This is moderate. This is severe drought. This is moderate drought. And this over here is just abnormally dry. Not so bad. The interesting thing about the map, as Patty, a Californian, can tell us, is that these areas that don't show extreme drought, those are areas that are so dry, you can't tell. So here's point number one, and that is that things are hot and dry, and they're going to get hotter and drier. All the climate models tell us that. I'm just trying to lay out themes that you might keep in mind as you come to the discussions down the line. So that's item number one, that it's hot and dry and it's going to get more so. And interestingly, it's going to be drier even if we continue to get as much precipitation as we had on average in the past. Now, why would that be? Well, it's because if it's hotter, there's more evaporation. And as I like to say, not even the U.S. House of Representatives has yet figured out how to repeal the law of evaporation. And so hotter means drier. So another little item, and this is, you know, New Mexico's not quite as sexy a state as California, so our graphics aren't always as good. But this is the diagram of where we are right now in terms of water storage in New Mexico. Elephant Butte is right now at 16% of capacity, Caballo at 18, Brantley at 80, but Brantley's a very small reservoir over on the Pecos, and Sumner at 79. The reason I'm showing this is to make the point that these days, there just isn't enough water to go around. Supply doesn't meet demand in New Mexico, or in most of the Southwest, in any of the Southwest. And that gap between supply and demand is going to get a lot greater as it becomes hotter and drier. So that's item number two to keep in mind. The climate models say that stream flow in our part of the world will probably decline by 10 to 30% by mid-century from its long-term average in the 20th century. So let's say 20% stream flow decline, that's the available water, the water that goes into reservoirs like these. We lose one-fifth of the supply that we're used to, and we're already over-allocated, so that's not a very good formula. So that's a lot of difficulty coming down the line. So New Mexico, right now, this is the shape we're in. Last year, there wasn't enough water on the Pecos to satisfy needs in Roswell and in Carlsbad. Carlsbad's irrigation system through most of the irrigation season was 100% dry. Only dust was flowing in those canals. On the Rio Grande, our deliveries to Texas were a lot less than Texas thought we should be delivering, and Texas has filed suit against New Mexico and has asked the Supreme Court to make a decision on whether we're living up to the terms of our compact agreement. So we're going to have interstate conflict. We've got it now. Texas has already appropriated $5 million to litigate that case. It's going to be an interesting case to watch. Keep your eye on that. Because if Texas wins, then the impacts for agriculture in the Mesilla Valley could be very, very heavy, and that'll be major societal strain down there, obviously. What we're going to see in the years ahead, it's not that we don't have enough water. As Jack's buddy Ed Abbey said, the Southwest has plenty of water, it just has the cities in all the wrong places. Right now, over 70% of all water in New Mexico is used for agriculture. In the years ahead, we'll see a lot of that water moving from agriculture to municipal and industrial uses. We'll see that movement of water from ag to other uses, and we'll have to wonder how we're going to feed ourselves. That's another story. But here's the deal for the cities, the towns in New Mexico that are going to suffer the most, and this is another thing to keep track of, are those that aren't connected to big water infrastructure. Think of Las Vegas, New Mexico. It's not near a big farming district. It gets its water from a small aquifer, a small watershed within the Sangre de Cristo, the Gallinas watershed. As that gets hard hit, and as its limited groundwater supplies go down, Las Vegas has nowhere to turn. Albuquerque's on the Rio Grande. It's connected. It's right next to, it's surrounded by the Middle Rio Grande Conservancy District. You'll see movement of water from the MRGCD in the decades ahead to Albuquerque. Santa Fe is connected through various plumbing to the Rio Grande system, so Santa Fe will be probably all right. Las Cruces, the same. It's the towns, the smaller towns, off a ways, that don't have access to buying agriculture water that are going to be looking at the toughest long-distance future. And a lot of people would say, okay, all we have to do is conserve our way out of the fix. But the problem with conservation is that in situation after situation, one community after another, the conserved water, when people save, when they get those low-flow toilets and take the shorter showers and all that kind of stuff and bring that per capita daily consumption of water down, 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 so often that saved water goes to the next strip mall or housing development down the road. And the people who use those facilities or live in those houses, those are good people too. And they conserve water. And they only use what they need. But pretty soon, you've got more and more people only using what they need. And this is a process called demand hardening. And when demand hardening means all the resources are used, but only as they must be used. And so when supply drops and you cut into what's there, you're cutting into really essential uses. Waste, actually, when drought comes, is our best friend because it's easy to pare back when you've got wasteful systems. We're getting more efficient, but we're getting more people, more uses in our systems through conservation. And so conservation, ironically, counterintuitively, can paint us into a tighter and tighter corner. So those of you who respond to your water utilities urging for conservation, always ask, how is this going to make us more water resilient? Where is the saved water going? Are you putting it in a reserve somehow? Are you saving it for the opposite of a rainy day? So conservation can help, but it can also be a trap. That's another theme that I hope will be brought up along the way down the line here with these panels. There really is no silver bullet to this situation. We're going to be wrestling with drought, with shortage, with scarcity for a long time. And in a way, it's wrong to call it drought. We're really moving to a new normal. And part of this new normal is going to be perpetual scarcity. As we move into that, one of the things that, as a society, we probably ought to keep in mind is that it's important never to waste a catastrophe. When things go wrong, that's a teachable moment. When things are tough, that's when sometimes you can rally people to make a change instead of, as we typically do in New Mexico, obeying the hydro-illogical cycle, which leads us, when we have drought and we move to awareness and we have concern, which goes to panic, well, then it rains again and everybody becomes happy. And that's as far as it goes. In terms of dealing with drought, in terms of dealing with shortage in New Mexico, know that our water infrastructure is very, very poorly funded. Our administrative infrastructure is very poorly funded, very poorly understaffed compared to what's going on in Colorado. If New Mexico really wants to deal with its water issues, we've got to bulk up. We ought to send some people up to Colorado, study their system, and hire away some of those folks to come down and help us out here. We've got a lot of holes in our water laws. And M. Hall and others who will be on the panels in the future, I'm sure we'll be talking about those things. There's a lot we can do to run our system a lot better. Another thing that we can keep in mind as these things go on is that history is always weighing on our shoulders. No big thing happens for just one reason. The drought and the scarcity and the shortage that we deal with in the future, the impacts will be shaped by where we've come from. And in New Mexico, the figures aren't so solid sometimes. So to illustrate this, I'm asking you to look at the water budget for the lower basin of the Colorado River. And that involves the states of Arizona, California, and Nevada. Nevada is a very small player. It's mainly California and Arizona. And I won't belabor this, but This is what's going on right now, this year. Water coming out of Hoover Dam, coming out of Lake Mead, being divvied up among California and Arizona mainly, the inflow to Lake Mead this year will be 8.25 million acre feet. That's determined by releases from Glen Canyon Dam mainly and some other factors. But the outflow from Lake Mead will be 10.3 million acre feet, which is to say the lower basin will be running a water deficit of over 2 million acre feet, 20% of the total supply. So at that rate, even without drought, Lake Mead will go dry. Lake Mead will go dead. The lake will fail in the parlance of water management, which is to say it'll drop to a level where water cannot pass the dam. So we're watching a sort of calamity building on the lower basin. All the managers know that it's a calamity building. They know that they have to do something about it. They're waiting for various legal triggers to be activated that will give them cause to deal with the very difficult politics. But it's going to be a hell of a game to watch. So if you enjoyed the Super Bowl, if you like water politics, this will be even better and more violent, perhaps, especially if John is out there going after some of the CEOs. All right, moving right along. And wrapping up here, here's the bottom line. The screws of drought are tightening down on us, really the screws of aridity, because as I say, it's a new normal. And the scary thing is that this being driven by climate change, by the warming of the globe, there's no top end to what can happen. We can sit here and we can criticize past generations for ignoring John Wesley Powell's wisdom or for digging the lower basin of the Colorado into the hole it's in today, but future generations will look back at us and look at our inaction on the most important thing in the globe today and think, we didn't measure up. We measured up even worse than those previous generations at the rate we're going. So just to cheerfully finish up here, I want to say, with social strain, we will see movement on the existing fault lines running through society in the Southwest. We'll see a lot of trouble along those lines. And it's interesting to observe that drought is different, for aridity is different from other catastrophes. After an earthquake, a hurricane, a typhoon, people tend to come together. Everybody's in the same boat, as it were. So folks have an equality of condition and they work together. Drought is different. You never know when it's really begun. You don't know you're in it until you've been in it for a while. You never know when it's going to end. So drought gives us all a very, very long time, lots of luxury of time to sit back and reflect, to meditate on all the deficiencies of our neighbors. And so drought tends to divide people. And drought can be very, very damaging that way. To wrap up, I want to borrow a story from Bill McKibben, a very great American doing the best work on climate of anyone that I know today. Bill gives talks constantly, and he was asked at a recent talk, "Well, Mr. McKibben, we know climate change is coming. We know we have to live with it. What's the best strategy for dealing with it? How do we live through this?" He says, "Live in a strong community." All right, Mr. McKibben, well, where do I find a strong community? Bill's answer was, you don't, you build it. Thanks.
Beautiful. Wow. I always enjoy listening to Bill's cheerful presentations because they give me, believe it or not, they do give me optimism.
One of the things I want to say before we go on to our dear pal Patty is that the four of us up here on the stage have been friends for a long time. And one of the things that I'm really hoping sort of comes out of this gathering up here is the friendship with everybody out there, because we are a community. And we have to invigorate a culture of practice that works successfully within the context of our watershed, our homeland. So, the third person on our panel is this wonderful lady sitting right here. She just made it in moments before the panel began from Boulder, Colorado, where she is the director of the Center for the American West. She's a wonderful author and a great teacher and a splendid thinker. Patty Limerick.
Oh, thank you. Well, my splendid author quality has already been displayed here with the quotation about Anza. And I will just start off by saying that our wonderful friend Ed Quillen, who was a great friend, he used to have the annual Anza Day celebration in Poncha Springs. And so I got drafted to give a speech on Anza. And I had just encountered one of those business books where lessons drawn from the lives of Sitting Bull, I believe it was, for business leaders. And that was such an interesting book in its own weird way. So that my essay is actually a parody of business manuals. And one of the sorrows of having a sense of humor is that you write something in a parody, and then you sound like you're a different person than you are. So, and my favorite part of that actually is the part where Anza, on one of his peaceful sides, I'm going to forget the exact number, but diplomacy required him, the Comanches hugged people as a gesture of reconciliation, and Anza hugged, I think it was 300 people in a row, just one after the other. I thought, I can hug people. I could not hug 300 people in a row without developing a negative attitude towards those people. So anyway, so I just wanted to clarify that, well, kind of a peacenik in some ways, so not really an advocate of wholehearted war. In fact, I think it's been a great disappointment to some people, as I sometimes sum up my transition, that I went from being controversial and contentious to being congenial and collaborative. And I think that was a bitter disappointment for people, some of whom might be sitting up here being bitterly disappointed by that that change. And I will say this, that when I was, I guess I was 32 or 3, and I took the bus, I lived in Arlington, Massachusetts, I took the bus into Cambridge, I got on the bus, an older gentleman was there, I sat next to him, and he went through a catalog of calamities and disasters coming down upon the planet, not unlike your passage there. And it's a 20-minute bus ride from Arlington to Cambridge, and he kept going along, and we were on Amazonian rainforest deforestation, and he didn't miss anything. He went through the whole catalog. And then this man had the nerve and effrontery to stand up as we got off at Harvard Square and to say to me, have a nice day. Speaking of being bitterly resentful, I mean, I still think, you goofy thing, get off the bus. And so I am not as inclined to join. I will probably not be joining my comrades in their mood here, because I actually am not a particular advocate of nostalgia. I have, in some cases, a few times recommended that we have a Surgeon General's warning on nostalgia, that thinking of the past as having been so conspicuously more...
It's not what it used to be.
Well, there you are. Yeah. And it wasn't then. No. Right? It wasn't then. So, so I wrote a book about the history of the Denver Water Department. And that was a pretty funny experience, because the two things that have moved me most, the two responses, one of them was a friend who teaches in the creative writing department at CU, and she's quite sophisticated as a reader and critic, and she ran into a friend, and the friend said, well, what are you reading these days, Catherine? She said, I'm reading a history of the Denver Water Department. And he said, how's that working out for you? And she said, it's entrancing, it's just a page-turner, and he walked away worried about her from... that. So I like that response, that she was standing up for that book, which I worked very hard to make readable. Has limericks in between the chapters. That's nice. And then my second favorite response, which I've heard from quite a number of people, people who work, and this will be, I don't know if they'll be pushing their chairs away from me soon, I guess, because this meant quite a bit to me. People who work in the water management business, I have now spoken to every group, keynote address, American Water Works Association, so on. People there, a number of people working in water management, water utilities, will come up to me and they'll say, I am so glad you wrote your book. I say, oh, thank you. And they'll say, my spouse read it. And my spouse said, now I know what you do. I never could figure out what you do. And I thought, oh, I'm a marriage counselor now. This is excellent. I'm intervening in marriages in a very positive way. So I am not able to go on the high ground here and haven't been able to visit the high ground for a long time. I'll just tell one more story here to suggest the framework that I'm about to take before I get more specifically to water. I had a friend in the Boston area, and he was summoned to jury duty. So he went into Boston to the courthouse. It was a, I don't know what, 12-story building. And it was a hot summer day, and he walked in, and it was hotter inside. And they said, oh, well, the air conditioning isn't working today, so it's really hot in here. Then he went to the elevators, and the elevators weren't working. He had to go to the 7th or 8th floor, so he climbed the stairs, very hot. Got off the staircase and then walked over and thought, well, at least I'll have a drink of water. And then the drinking fountain wasn't working. And at that point, he looked over, and there was a man standing by the drinking fountain, and he said to the man, whew, the way they treat us, you'd think we were the criminals. And the man standing by the drinking fountain said, well, I am a criminal. So then that was a conversation that didn't really go anywhere. So then they went into the jury, into the courtroom, where the prospective jurors, my friend included, were being assembled. And the man who had just been chatting at the fountain was the defendant in the case. And so the judge said, is there anybody in the jury pool who has had any prior contact with the defendant? And my friend had to say, well, yes. And the juror said, well, what was the nature of, or the judge said, what is the nature of your contact? He said, well, I had a brief conversation with him. And the judge said, well, what was the nature of your conversation? So he had to tell this story. And then all the jurors had to be dismissed because it was basically a confession. So I have loved that story for all kinds of reasons. But my main reason is that it permits me to say to you, I am a criminal. I flew here.
I did too.
Well, what do you know? So, yeah, so carbon troubles. Well. So there's that. And I could have Skyped in. I could have, although there would have been some electricity generation to make that happen. I don't succeed in getting to a place of standing outside this world of unfortunate resource use. If I try to do that, well, one more historical comparison. I think of the difference in the missionaries in the Pacific Northwest. There were Catholic missionaries and there were Presbyterian missionaries, Marcus and Narcissa Whitman, Presbyterians, and others. So the missionaries came into that area in the 1820s, 1830s, and they started trying to convert Indians. The Catholics, the Jesuits, had a kind of adaptable, well, hi, would you like more firearms? Is there something we can do to help you with ammunition? And we have some rather beautiful paintings we'd like to show you, and so on. So they were much more, they sat around, they had lunch, they chatted. The Presbyterians wanted to convince everyone that they lived in darkness, that the Indians lived in darkness and would have to confess deep and terrible sin before they could be saved. Well, guess who made more converts? So if I were able to climb up to the high ground, I think I would climb back down because I don't see that as a very, it didn't work for the, as you may remember what happened to Marcus and Narcissa Whitman, you don't want that to happen to you. That was a massacre, let's just be frank, it was a massacre. So there is a stance that after working on that book on Denver water, I'm especially unequipped to do that. The disconnect between consumers and producers is astounding to me. It's always been more or less astounding to me. Working on that book, being in Denver, having waiters come up to me and say, would you like water? And my thinking, have you got half an hour so I can talk about how this water got here? To see the obliviousness with which most people in that community, many other communities, live with that caused me to coin a phrase that's not having any success in catching on. In the book, it's called A Ditch in Time, and the phrase, which I think is an absolutely perfect phrase and should catch on, is to refer to our last century of life as the era of improbable comfort, the era of improbable comfort made possible by a truly astonishing but entirely taken for granted infrastructure.
Wow, that works for me.
Thank you. By the fourth time you were able to say it, the first three times you struggled, but the fourth time, people still prefer Gilded Age or something like that. I don't know why. But that is where we have lived for a long time, and that era troubles me. That era it's troubling to think of so many people turning switches, turning on faucets, and not having a moment's consciousness of where the resource is coming from. And then, on the rare occasions when they do have consciousness over the preceding 30 or 40 years, the custom has been to say, well, I certainly want to turn the faucet and get the water. I certainly want to flip the switch and get the electricity. I certainly want to go to the thermostat and heat the house with natural gas, because I'm having a rally here to oppose the development of natural gas, and I wouldn't want my guests to be uncomfortable at the rally. So people can do that, and then from time to time, something comes, maybe a blog that they look at or something. They see the site of production of the resource that they have gotten so used to, and they are very angry at the disruption of that site. And so the best thing to do with that emotion when they feel it is to find an engineer and condemn the engineer, because the engineer is the person who, over the last century or the era of improbable comfort, our relationship, the American people's relationship with the engineering profession, has been to say, get us our resources at low cost the second we want it. If you disrupt service, we're going to be very surly, and we can be really surly. So that has been our relationship with the engineering profession, which then every now and then when we come to consciousness about what they're doing to get us our resource, we say, never make places ugly the way you do that. We hate that. But we want to turn the faucet, we want to flip the switch, and so on. So that's got to change. That's not a healthy way of going through life. My most immediate prescription, which I hope you will adopt, is never have a dinner party without inviting an engineer to it. And as you dine, look around the room to think where an engineer made it happen, made it possible. That's not to say that we give them their heads and let them make all the choices, but that we recognize our responsibility and our complicity. Okay, so I wrote this book on the history of the Denver Water Department. It gave me an inability to look at the substance in here without astonishment. I live with wonder over that. That seems a great way to live. I live with wonder when I see the Denver Water Department has a new diversion from the Western Slope, the last one they will make without complete buy-in and cooperation from the Western Slope, and they do actually have a statewide agreement where a lot of the Western Slope counties think that they are getting something out of this operation as well. Anyway, Denver Water does want to increase its storage on the Front Range with this one more significant diversion from the Western Slope. The neighbors that live around the reservoir, the Gross Reservoir, and that's not gross as in a sin against the planet, but Gross is the name of the engineer that it's called after, which is it's a hard name to have. So the neighbors around the Gross Reservoir wrote a very, very angry attack on the expansion. They could have put a dam in an untouched canyon. Instead, they are raising an existing dam and increasing the storage in what is already a disrupted canyon. That suggestion came from environmentalists in the 1970s and 1980s who were opposing the Two Forks Dam and a new canyon. So the originators of the Expand Gross Reservoir, that was environmentalists saying, don't build Two Forks, take an existing disrupted canyon and increase the storage. So the neighbors of the Gross Reservoir Dam who opposed the expansion wrote a very angry letter condemning the Denver Water Department for its failures of sustainability, for its arrogance, for its greed, for its abuse of the planet, and failure of sustainability was what they kept coming back to. The neighbors of the Gross Reservoir drive 20 or 25 miles in and out to get to town on subsidized roads with fossil fuel expenditures. They are disruptors of wildlife habitat. They're in forests where, in fact, if they chose to inconvenience wild animals, I don't know how they could do it more effectively. And they are living on groundwater. They're pumping water. So, with as much care as I could, I wrote about the dilemma there. I do not say that those people should be supportive of the Denver Water Department or anything like it, but they could take a moment to look in a mirror. It could take just a moment to do that and then decide what they want to do about that. So my plan was never to have this problem of having friends who work for water utilities. I was planning to stay very pure in these matters, and I ended up with some real water quality issues of the soul here because I know too many of them. I see the way in which they are acting at society's request. Some of those same members of society seem to be comfortable in condemning them while using the resources they provide. To go back to the point that others have made, 85% of Colorado water goes to agriculture. A much, much smaller percent, 4 or 5%, goes to cities. The bulk of the population is in those areas using the tiny percentage. What are those people eating? Of course, they're eating food that's produced with that water. At this point, much alarm in the state of Colorado about hydraulic fracturing and natural gas production using vast amounts of water, enormous quantities of water, and so on. That's the way it's usually put. 0.01% of the water is going to natural gas development, 85% to agriculture. And just, again, there's nothing that says everyone should object. It's a First Amendment country. It's a joy to object. But with just a little bit of putting those numbers together and looking at it at the same time, and I conclude with a tribute to my friend Maria Montoya, who is a historian at New York University. She grew up a family from New Mexico, grew up in a lot of childhood in Colorado. She is a very fine historian. She writes wonderful history, and she has a cousin who invented a better kind of ditch liner for agriculture. So part of the 85% in Colorado and 70% here that's going into agriculture is going pretty rapidly straight into the air from evaporation from leakage, or into the air or into the surrounding terrain through leakage. So Maria took a break from writing history to serve as the chair of the board of her cousin's ditch lining company, the company that produces the ditch liners that makes agriculture so much more effective. And as an historian, I'm humbled by that, that Maria went beyond writing a piece lamenting the failures of water management and is actually a businesswoman. She is at this moment in Israel, where she is visiting the places that originated drip agriculture, or drip irrigation for agriculture. So that's a practice of history that Maria Montoya represents that I am humbled by and hope. What a terrible chair of a board I would be for a company. I guess I can't do that. But I hope that at some point I could have a life that had the meaning that Maria Montoya's life had when it comes to water issues. So those are my remarks.
Thank you, Patty. Well, what Patty has reiterated is that we all live in a state of conflicting absolutes. And that's the hard part. I'm really sorry, we're running low on time. What happens is when a bunch of us get together is it can go on all night, and what I really would dig is if we could all get into it, and John can sleep with whoever he wants to. Anyway, well, I'm going to cut us off now. We've got to stop because I'm getting signals, but thank you so much for coming.
And that was Jack Loeffler, John Nichols, Bill DeBuise, and Patty Limerick in the first of a series of 5 panel discussions on water culture and climate change in the West, Thinking Like a Watershed, recorded at the Chemo Theater in Albuquerque. We will be airing the series each Monday for the next 4 weeks. The next panel will focus on perspectives of indigenous people and their cultural relationships to homeland. Speakers will include Rena Swensel from the Santa Clara Pueblo, Lyle Balenqua from the Hopi Independent Nation, and Esteban Arellano Acequiero from Emburo, New Mexico. The panels are funded and sponsored by the New Mexico Humanities Council and The Lore of the Land. They are produced and moderated by oral historian, author, and producer Jack Loeffler.